Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Tara Reid. She is a CEO at AppsWithoutCode.com. She's worked at Microsoft and Google, went to Columbia, been all over the place, and now she is helping people make apps without knowing how to code. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm thrilled to talk to you because, you know, everyone is out there saying we should learn how to code, teach people how to code, and maybe that's not the right way to go about things.
Yeah. I mean, I think more than anything, we should teach people how to be great problem solvers and to really understand logic and solving problems with logic. Sometimes that looks like doing it with code. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, it seems like we should be teaching people how to think. You know, I've done podcasts with people about systems thinking, and
You
know, that's a way to think.
Absolutely. It definitely is. So I primarily work with, you know, people who self-identify as non-technical, which, you know, can mean a lot of different things, but primarily for people who are not proficient enough in writing code such that they have an app idea, but they can't crank it out immediately and build it really quickly. And that could be people who are really good at writing code. They just don't have, you know, the time or want to invest all the time in building, and writing new code for their idea when they don't even know if it's something that people want, and it could be someone who totally doesn't know code at all.
Why do people choose to self-identify for, like, I'm not technical? It almost seems like it's a defensive maneuver.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's people feel insecure about not being technical in the tech industry. And I think a lot of unintentional shame gets put on people inside of tech companies who are not the developers, right? When all roles inside of a company are super important. But I think that people feel maybe embarrassed that they don't know how to write code, and so they call themselves non-technical. I'm not even sure what that means exactly, because there are some pretty technical people who also don't, you know, are not developers. So, you know, I think people sometimes will say that and sort of put themselves down or try to protect themselves as an insecurity thing. Yeah, that's what I've seen.
I wonder why people choose to do that and where that started. I mean, I recognize that people who know how to code are proud of it, and I know that I'm excited to have that sense of empowerment, but why we have set up the system by which we disempower people who can't do that, as opposed to enabling them.
I mean, I think inside of a tech company, you know, as you mentioned, I've worked at some big ones. You know, there's a hierarchy, it seems, of the people who work there, with developers largely at the top, particularly at startups, right? And I think that that's sort of some of where it comes from. But I think that the negative effect is that people who are in non-developer roles inside of a company then feel like the kind of critical thinking that comes with being a developer is not for them. They can't do it. And it actually, I think, ends up biting the developers in the butt, because then they get asked all sorts of questions, some of them being relatively simple questions that someone could have figured out on their own, or if they had a little bit of knowledge about code or about, you know, just technology in general, they could have, you know, asked a more directed question. They could have spoke the developer's language a little bit better. And I think it kind of that stigma and that divide between technical and non-technical actually prevents us from really effectively communicating.
That's interesting that you point out that it's as much about being technical as it is about communicating with the technical people.
Absolutely.
It's almost like that frustration with talking to programmers. It causes one to just say, I'm not technical.
They're absolutely. You know, so I run a program that's called Apps Without Code Bootcamp, and I mainly work with people who identify as non-technical, and a lot of them have a lot of fear around talking to a developer, that developer not understanding what it is that they were trying to say. So again, communication, and mm-hmm. then getting a result from their product that just totally wasn't what they wanted or what they were trying to communicate, and feeling like they've wasted their money or their time working with that person. You know, that's one of the results of us having this divide between technical and non-technical, as well.
Hmm. So when a non-technical or a person who's not coding, or actually, you know, I'm just realizing it, it's not just non-technical, but it's people who may not have experience in a particular platform. For example, you might be listening to this podcast and you've got 20 years in technology, but you've never made an iPhone app.
Yeah. Yeah. People who don't have experience in a particular platform, or people who are validating an idea and know that the faster they can validate that, the better off they'll be. And that includes even people who have experience in that particular platform who want to build something in a fraction of the time, make sure they can make money from it, and then, okay, we'll go back and do the coding work.
That's interesting. How important is it to validate the idea? I mean, I assume the point of validating idea is to know when to bail, because you don't want to, you know, you see these people on Shark Tank that are like, I've been putting 35 years and $1 million and I mortgaged our house, and then they're off the Shark Tank.
Right.
And it's like, that's so sad.
Yeah, absolutely. You definitely need to know when to bail, but also, like, none of us get our ideas right the first time. And we know this as well for, you know, folks who are listening who work at big companies. You definitely know this. We just don't really talk about it inside of company space. You know, that's why we continuously iterate on products. That's why we have support teams, and why support teams often sort of rotate with the eng teams, because the engineers need to see what people are saying in support tickets and like, oh, I didn't think that this feature would be really confusing to all the consumers, but it actually ended up being really confusing. You know, all those things, the same thing happens when you build a new product, except it's magnified, right? There could be particular features you thought were going to be really, really important. I actually remember my first startup that I launched, it was called Collecto, and I thought that it was an art recommendation service, and mm-hmm. I thought that it was going to be really important to, I wanted to still have a little bit of a human touch in there in addition to a recommendation algorithm. And I wanted people to be able to interact somewhat with like a personal stylist for their walls. And I thought it was going to be so important that people be able to video chat, and that we have video as a really, really critical component of the platform. And I couldn't get anyone to get on video chat, right? It just turned out the people who didn't know much about art, they were totally intimidated by the idea of talking mm-hmm. to someone who knew a lot about art. And if I had gone out and spent a lot of time building the best, you know, video integrated platform, I would have totally wasted my time. So most of us don't get it exactly right. The vision we have of exactly how the product should look is not spot on when we first start. And so there may be tools you want to use to just quickly build something. And when I say quickly, you know, the tools that I teach people how to build apps without code on these days, developers pick them up, you know, in a fraction of the time. So if mm-hmm. you can build your entire app in a day or two and then just get it out there, and when I say build, I mean from idea to pushed to the app store in a day or two, why not? Make sure that people want it. You've got the core features in place, and then you can make quick changes as opposed to, you know, really investing in a lot of technical debt.
Why do people feel the need to put something out that's super polished? And why are people so kind of ashamed, for lack of a better word, of putting out a website or an app that isn't clean? It's almost like when we were kids and we were told to write a paper, we're always ashamed of that first draft to the
yeah.
point that we almost deny that it exists.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of us want to look good, right? Like, that's all centered in just the human instinct to look good. But a good friend of mine, he says, hell is building fancy stuff that nobody uses. Right? Like, it's fun. Okay, it looks really great, but nobody cares. And that's literally the worst. If you were a product developer, and you say product developer, meaning whether you code or not, you can still develop products. That's the worst. It's building fancy stuff nobody uses.
You've got a great blog post called My Website Isn't Ready to Launch Yet.
Yeah.
And you kind of explore that idea of that self-doubt. It seems like we need to remind people that fail fast, fail often is how you get things done these days.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you guys have read, or folks who are listening have read, Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell.
Mm-hmm.
it's actually a really good, you know, illustration of, you know, the things and the people that we see as being really successful are, yes, successful, but for a variety of reasons, the main one being that they've just had a ton of practice, right? And that practice can be launching something and failing it and then launching it again and getting it a little bit better, but they're constantly putting themselves out there. And that extends from like sports players where they're just always practicing to developers where they're just like always launching things, or any kind of entrepreneur really where you're always launching things. And you are not going to hit that sort of success space unless you're always putting stuff out there. Some of those things will be failures and some of the things will be successes. And that's how you get there, by just putting a bunch out there.
Sometimes I've seen like Medium posts or blogs where someone says, you know, put out a website that's super basic with a sign up sheet, even if the product doesn't exist, in order to gauge interest in the product. And if people sign up, then you'll know, well, 1,000 people signed up. I should definitely, you know, start building this thing. That seems like a powerful, you know, life hack, but it also seems like it might be a little disingenuous.
No, I think it's really smart, actually. Mm-hmm. I do that, and I instruct people to do that as well. And, mm-hmm. you know, the reason why is because for it to work, it has to be accompanied by a solid marketing strategy is often the piece, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people say just build your website and see if people sign up. Well, like, that's not really how it happens, right? Like, if you build a website, you have to do a lot of work to get people to know about your website and get them to sign up, right? That's where the marketing piece comes in. Mm-hmm. And then you have to leverage. So what I usually tell people to do is have people sign up and get on the waiting list for your product. And what it allows you to do is slowly take people off of the waiting list and to kind of manage your workload. And when I say slowly, I mean literally you can take people off 5 people at a time, 10 people at a time to use your product. It also is a smart marketing strategy because not only does it manage your workload, but it also creates some urgency, right? People are like, oh, there's a wait list for this. This might be cool. And it's smart from a marketing perspective as well. So I think it's a great way to go, and it allows you to see if anyone's interested. It allows you to see, like, is the way I'm describing this something that resonates with people, or am I totally describing it in a way where no one cares? All right, well, let me play around and tweak the language. Let me tweak some of the things that are on the site and see if I can kind of get something that resonates with people a little bit better. And then once you have people signing up, then you kind of treat your sign-up customers as investors. I'm a huge advocate for building products where you charge people up front instead of having, you know, completely freebie apps and products. But what you're able to do is see, like, is anybody going to pay for this thing? And then what you put yourself in is a position where you don't have to go begging and crawling to an investor for money, because you've used your customers as kind of some of your early quote-unquote investors for the product.
Interesting. Someone told me about the theory of 1,000 true fans.
Yeah.
You heard about this, right?
Yeah.
So you're telling me that your early people, your early, you know, people who bet on you and your idea early really aren't just, they're investors, they are your fans, and they are the ones that can also help you potentially pivot if you need to make a change.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So we hear this term pivot a lot, and sometimes you see these things on Hacker News, and you see it on like Silicon Valley on that TV show where these things become buzzwords, though. But you're not saying that pivoting is a bad thing if you are going to fail on something.
No, I think pivoting is a great thing. The one challenge is I see people fall into two camps. Either they're not pivoting at all, so they're just completely stuck on this one idea that they have in their head. And usually those people are not actually getting much traction on their idea, whether that's development traction, they're just not getting much built, or they're not getting a lot of customer traction because they're too scared to put it out there. So usually the people who are really, really attached to their idea, they're not making a lot of progress. Or there's people who have heard about this concept of pivoting and are pivoting like crazy before they even get any real customer feedback. Like every time they get a new idea, there's a pivot. And so I think that both of those extremes are not where you want to be. You don't want to be pivoting every time you have a new idea. All of your pivots should be grounded in some of that feedback that you get from your, you know, first 1,000 true fans, right? If you're seeing really clear trends on things that are confusing to people or things that people want, etc., you should be pivoting around those, but not just when you get a new idea.
So it sounds like whether you're technical or not, all of the decisions that you make need to be kind of rooted in, for lack of a better word, conscious thought. Like there has to be a reason, there has to be data, there has to be, research behind the reasons that you do what you do.
Yeah. And I would even go even further to say rooted in something that multiple customers have said, and when I say said, I don't mean they actually have to say those words. Sometimes customers of technology products, they don't know how to articulate what they want, but they can tell you by not clicking on that thing you want them to click on, right? So that's where the data comes in, but it's mainly because of something the customer said, if you use the word said in a little bit more of a loose way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, what about people who have a co-founder and they're two people? Does it always need to be like one Bill Gates and one Ballmer, where one's technical and one's not? Or can two non-technical founders work on a startup idea together?
I think two non-technical founders can definitely work on a startup idea together. And I think two technical folks can as well. I think that for me as an entrepreneur, what's really important is to constantly be working with coaches to develop skills that I don't have or that I'm a little bit weak on. And sometimes mm-hmm. that means that like I'm bartering with a friend. Right. So I, for example, am not a designer and there are designers on my team. And a couple months ago, I wanted to just have a better grasp on managing my designers and be able to do a better job as a manager there and as a CEO. And so I hired and sort of bartered with a friend of mine who used to work on, his name is Xander Pollock. He used to work on the Gmail team and he taught me about the Google Ventures Design Sprint. And so I have a better grasp on what it looks like to design a product because I've rolled up my sleeves and gone through that process. And I am not a designer. I'm not the designated designer on that team, but it doesn't mean that I can't learn design. And that is a really good way if you have two technical people, two non-technical people, where you can sort of balance some things out. But I think that if you are launching a product, launching a company, you should always be figuring out how you can learn things and bring on coaches, for lack of a better word, to help you with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Google Ventures Design Sprint, and I'll have links to all of this in the show notes, is at gv.com/sprint. It's aiming to provide a shortcut, because you've got your idea, you're going to build your idea, you launch your idea, and then you take information and you learn, and then you kind of refine that idea. The intent is with these design sprints is to tighten that up, that inner loop, and make it even quicker.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what tools do people use? I know that you have a toolkit that people can go up and download. They'll get a free ebook on Apps Without Code toolkit. Are you intending that people use like drag and drop tools to create prototypes, or are they really making apps in the sense that I think about them as it being applications?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'm talking about are people building fully functioning apps. So not just prototypes where you click it, but you can't actually save a database of information, etc. So there are a couple different types of tools out there. The one that I recommend to people who are a little bit more on the tech savvy side is called Bubble. Bubble.is is the website. And it's definitely the most robust tool out there, at least right now as we speak. But there are a ton others, dozens, tens of dozens others. And Bubble has a couple core tabs. I'll kind of describe this to you, but you're welcome to go check out the website. Mm-hmm. And
this is at bubble.is.
Exactly.
For people that are listening.
Exactly. And so there's a design tab. And that design tab just looks like a regular drag drop editor. So you drag and drop shapes on the page and different elements on the page. And there's some more sophisticated design work that you can do there, but it looks like more or less a drag and drop interface. And then there is a database tab, and this is where you set up your database however you want. So you've got free rein to set up the database with whatever structure that you need, and you set up your database and you can always change it there on the data tab. And then there's a third tab, which is the workflow tab. And for the most part, this is where the replacement of the code happens. And I usually tell people, you're still programming, you're just doing it in a different language. Really, what Bubble has built is their own programming language. It's just in, conversational English, as opposed to anything else. And so what it looks like is like a really, really simple example I give to beginners is like when the user clicks this button, then log them in. And it literally says that. And then it'll ask you some follow-up questions where you put certain, you know, pieces of information around what happens when you log them in. So log them in using the email that they typed into the email field and the password that they typed into the password field. And when you use the log them in function in Bubble, it already knows that if it doesn't match up to the password they have on file, it will give a certain, you know, response that says, sorry, that password doesn't match. We don't have an account that way. And you can change the messaging that you want, but it kind of has that logic set up. And so it's just really if this, then that logic, and you can get, that's a really simple example, but you can get really robust with this and build algorithms and all sorts of things here on the platform, just using logic, but it's written in conversational English statements as opposed to in a different programming language.
Interesting. So it sounds like for kind of, you know, classic web, you know, text boxes over data or apps with maps and alerts and the kinds of things that we see all the time, this could get, you know, 80, 90% of the people quite a lot of functionality. It's got MailChimp, it's got search engines and integrations all built in.
Yeah, absolutely. And then let's say, for example, you wanted to plug in and pull in some API connections. You can do that too. So it gets people a lot of the functionality that they have for really basic apps. And then there are other tools out there. Like let's say that you wanted to build a video game without code. There's a tool called Stencil that allows you to do that. If you wanted to build artificial intelligence chatbots, there's a tool called motion.ai. So there are a couple, you know, specific functionality kind of tools that focus on different functionality depending on what you're trying to do. And then there are a lot of things that you still can't build without code these days, right? And by the way, all of these platforms are built with code, right? Just with interfaces that allow you to build them without code. So oftentimes I get people saying like, well, does this mean that we don't need code anymore? And like the answer is absolutely, that's not what it means. It just opens up for, you know, all the developers out there who have friends asking them all the time to build their app idea. It allows you to direct them to a place where they can get started, make sure that this is something that people want on their own. And then you kind of come in once it's validated and ready for you, as opposed to having all of your friends ask you and beg you.
That is a really interesting point. At the same time, though, how do you, let's just use you as an example. You know, you've launched your businesses, you've, you know, pivoted on some, sold some.
Yeah.
But at the same time, aren't you becoming technical? Like maybe you'll wake up one day and you'll be a coder and not even realize it. If you're using Bubble successfully, you're probably coding now. You're just not coding in a language that most people are familiar with.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So in a lot of ways, you become technical. And I think that there are, when we talk about technical, whatever that means, there are kind of different layers to that and different degrees with which you are technical. But at least you become far more technical than you once were. And that allows you to do, as a quote-unquote non-technical person, allows you to do a lot of things. One of which is to take a first idea, first stab of an idea and a product that you've built, validate it, and then bring it to someone who does write code to then have them layer on. And sometimes people will continue using a platform like Bubble. Mm-hmm. And other times, so because you can layer code on top of it, so you can layer Java or some other things on top of Bubble, or you can, you know, create your own API connections using code. So it's not just for people who write code. Or you can just completely move off of it and work on your own platform.
Interesting. Okay. So you're not necessarily, you know, looking at the internals of HTTP and doing, you know, but you know what an API is.
Right.
That makes sense. So then, you know, becoming technical can just be even being an enthusiast or someone who, you know, knows what MailChimp is and how MailChimp fits into a solution without having to know the internals of the API that talk to MailChimp.
Absolutely. And I think that that's what's happening. The interesting thing that's happening in the industry is that there are a lot of tools popping up that can allow you to be technical without knowing the ins and outs. Like, for example, if I want to do web scraping of a website, there are clear web scraping tools that I can use that don't require me to know any code. I literally, they have click interfaces where I can click on all the different elements of a page, set it up such that it scrapes it, and then I know that there is an API connection in Bubble. I maybe don't know anything more than that. I just know it's called an API, and what it'll do is it'll pull in what I just web scraped into my app, and that's all I need to know in order for that to actually get done and set up, right?
Yeah. So pulling this all the way back to the initial kind of couple of statements where we talked about how everyone is out there focusing on people learning to code, there is a risk that someone might spend all this time trying to figure out what a for loop is or how HTML works, but they're missing the big picture about how humans interact with apps and the app store and how marketing is important and business development and business plans are important as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I find that the developers who join my programs and my boot camps, they're not coming because they don't know how to code. They're coming because they realize that even if they do code the most perfect app, you know, it's not going to get marketed itself. It's not going to have a solid business model on its own. And so those are all equally important pieces of the puzzle. On top of that, I think that there are different scenarios for learning to write code. If you want to learn to code because you're excited about the intellectual challenge of it, that's what you definitely should learn to write code. If you want to learn code because you want to get a job working in like a 9-to-5 job working in tech, then you definitely should write code. You're not going to come into the conversation in the interview saying I build apps without code, at least not today. But if you have an idea for a startup and you don't write code, it does not always benefit you to go say, all right, well, I've got to go learn code, because by the time you get proficient enough to build a robust and sophisticated app, the idea may not be relevant anymore. Someone else has done it. And so if you need speed on your side, it makes a lot of sense to use some of these emerging alternatives.
Interesting. It seems like people could get caught up in trying to learn to code and miss the forest for the trees when they're trying to ship a solution,
right?
Not know how to code.
Right. Right.
Interesting. So people can get all of your resources at appswithoutcode.com. Exactly. You've got a boot camp, you've got a blog, you've got even a TED Talk that people can watch where kind of all this started.
Yeah, absolutely.
That TED Talk turned out pretty well. How did that happen?
So I had been blogging about my experience building apps without code for a while. And I think I had like 100 subscribers. I was mainly talking to myself. Mm-hmm. But there were people who were just so enthusiastic about it, and it offered up an opportunity for them that they didn't even think was possible. And so from that, I got an invitation to do that TEDx talk. And after that, really got a lot more feedback on the idea and a lot of interest in it. Good and bad, right? Like, some people hate this as an idea. But I think it's really empowering for most people, more than anything.
You know, and I like that you said empowering. It's actually one of my favorite words, because I think that what people who are technical have or feel, I know I do, is a sense of I can do it, a sense of power.
Yeah.
And, you know, in this kind of the state of the world today, so many people feel like they don't have power, whether it be over their job or their life or their situation. What's so fun about being a techie?
Yeah.
And when I say techie, I want to include both non-technical and technical people, you know, enthusiasts, is that sense of power. And it sounds like that's what you're trying to get people to realize, that they are powerful and they can do this.
Exactly.
That's very cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.